Tennessee, the 16th state of the United States, was discovered and claimed by the Spanish Inquisition in 1540. Renowned explorer Juan Emilio Pepe La Cucaracha de Vinos Noches Benghazi was in search of a shortcut to the East Indies and had just forded the Mississippi River when he happened upon a plain on which stood thousands of teepees. By any stretch of the unusually pliant Spanish imagination, it was vast. The wigwams extended as far as Benghazi's eyes could be dotted. His language was richly descriptive when it came to things like food, Spanish omelette.
I'm good at that. Spanish omelette. Spanish omelette.
Combat.
Combat. Spanish omelette. Oh, wait. No.
Combat.
Combat. Spanish-American war.
Bromeliads.
Spanish moss.
And entomology.
Spanish fly. What about etymology?
What about etymology?
Spanish fly.
Oh. However, it had no word for the scene that lay before him. So Vinos Noches appropriated his English footman's term, tent city. But because 16th century Spaniards hadn't yet learned how to wrap their tongues around affricatives, they pronounced it Tennessee.
Tennessee. How do you know that they couldn't wrap their tongues around it? Were you there watching the tongue wrapping?
I was watching the unwrapping.
The wrapping.
Benghazi noticed a plume of smoke rising from one of the teepees, which led him to theorize that it was inhabited. This was confirmed moments later when a colossal clamor erupted from within the structure, and hundreds of vermilion-skinned musicians spilled outside. Benghazi assumed they were musicians. Each clutched a drum, or flute, or helicon, or other sound-producing implement. And what he initially dismissed as unapologetic cacophony gradually assumed the melodic contour and rhythmic intensity of Indian love call. A little Paleolithic ditty that had about as much in common with Amerindian romance as Popiel's Pocket Fisherman has with the particle accelerator at CERN. In time, the music became more frenetic. I guess that's frenetic, heralding a mock battle. The women with the helicons attacked and routed their male counterparts with the... routed their male counterparts with the flutes, while the drummers settled into a torrid tattoo that would resurface 4 1/4 centuries later as the rhythmic component of Inagada da Vida. To be sure, this unexpurgated display of a primitive culture's sacred rite was spellbinding, and Benghazi ordered his men to conceal themselves so they wouldn't spook the performers. That wasn't good enough for one overachieving anthropologist who was determined to get a better view of the spectacle. Disguising himself as a conifer, at the edge of a deciduous forest of all places, the operative managed to slip away and plant himself seemingly unnoticed right in the midst of the action. And what action it abruptly became. Following a G minor triad that sounded like it issued from the bowels of a giant termite mound...
I don't have any G minor triad.
Oh, okay.
Much as I would like to have.
Oh, well. All of the helicons simultaneously broke apart, revealing 40 or so silviculturists. Benghazi assumed they were silviculturists. Each sported a gabardine breechclout, festooned with a chainsaw totem. Ignoring the still raging melee, they extracted tomahawks from somewhere in their nether regions and proceeded to chop down the 24 or of the nearby trees, including the conifer that would likely soon cease concealing the anthropologist.
Benghazi. I know him. He is a modern-day explorer.
But this is
Benghazi.
Benghazi tried to recall if he had lost a crew member in a stupider circumstance and concluded he probably hadn't.
Binos!
Ah, Binos Noches.
Binos!
May have felt blasé over the imminent demise of one of his team, but Jorge, head of security, didn't. Under his watch, the expedition had lost none of its members, and he was not about to let that happen now if he could help it. So he disregarded Benghazi's command and attacked the musicians single-handedly. Armed with only a bag of Spanish onions, however, he was no match for the drummers, who parried with a flurry of paradiddles, flam taps, and an especially devastating barrage of triple rademikus. In years to come, that assault might be replicated in McGuffey's diner.
It might be.
The assault quickly brought Jorge to his knees. Regrettably for the frolicking Amerindians, it also brought down, so to speak, the house. Or houses, really. The scads of teepees, I'm sorry to report, had been erected on what one day would be known as the New Madrid Seismic Zone. And the percussive hullabaloo set off a massive trembler that caused a giant rift to open in the earth into which all of the teepee dwellers plunged. Many members of the Benghazi expedition were too stunned to flee and were also swallowed up by the seismological calamity. Those who survived, including
Binos
Noches, now headed north, and in time they did stumble upon the East Indies. A little more than 3 centuries later, the Mossy Creek Missionary Baptist Seminary broke ground on the Amerindian burial ground. By itself, that action would seem to have little bearing on activities here in the Calvos and Damien Control Center. However, the MCMBS later reinvented itself as Carson Newman College, home of the Marching Eagles. And what representative from that institution has petitioned to subject his music to us and, by extension, to you, our listening audience? You'll find out only if you turn up the volume on your radio receiver a bit, wipe off your feet, then join Calvos and Damien's musicological hunter-gatherers
in the house.
And we are in the house.
What?
Here we are.
Yeah, so what?
What do you mean, so what?
This is a good thing.
This is what we're supposed to be doing.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
It is?
It is.
Your screen's
yes,
just went out.
Yes, that's right. All right, we have a guest.
No.
What do you have there in front of you?
I have notes.
You have notes?
Notes, yes. I have a quiz to prepare.
Well, our guest today on Calvos and Damien
in the house
is Jay, I don't know what it's for, Jay Ryan Garber, a composer who's currently south of us somewhere where it's not snowing yet.
It will be by the time this interview is over.
So welcome to the show, Ryan.
Maybe.
Well, thank you very much. The J is for just Ryan Garber.
Actually, it's for John,
but you can put anything you want to there. Just would be okay. Just me. Or Jester, yeah.
Jester Garber.
Yes.
It's Jester Garber. Okay. that's my knockdown. What do they call those? Clowns.
I actually have a Jester hat I purchased, and it is, it's not true leopard skin, but it's a kind of like a white leopard skin Jester hat.
Just for today?
Not just for today, no. And I don't even have it on today, but I bought one, so just to have for when I'm jesting.
Question number one.
Okay.
Uh-oh, here comes his quiz.
The Thomas Recital Hall seats how many?
Ooh, wow, that's interesting. Approximately 250 people. Depends on whether or not you move out some of the chairs that can be moved to accommodate other things that could be there.
Very well.
Does he get a ding or a buzz?
Ding, ding!
Okay.
Question number two. How many ranks in the Reuter organ?
How many ranks in the Reuter organ? That would be 34. Although sometimes it's listed as 35, but I think 34 is probably the answer you're looking for. And
it's listed as 32.
32. Oh, well, how about that?
Please fill in the blank. The Tar Music Center has blank square feet of floor space.
Oh, let's see. Not enough.
Can he answer in meters?
Not enough.
Meters.
Okay.
Not enough. I think we'll give that a ding.
Ding!
Ding! Okay, for extra credit, how many grounded outlets does the Electronic Center have?
That, too, would be not enough.
Well, we can't have that answered twice.
Okay. How many does the Electronic Center grounded outlets?
As opposed to grounded artists,
yes.
Which is an entirely different
grounded
state of
affairs. Grounded outlets. I'm going to see 20.
20. Well, I have no idea, so that can be a ding.
Ding!
Two more. What item of apparel do Eric Thorson, Angela Holder, and Perry Ward have in common?
Item of apparel.
Yes.
They are wearing some sort of academic regalia.
Beats me. I just made up the question.
A hat.
Yes, a hat.
Regalia, yes.
And finally, how many credit hours are offered by the Marching Eagles? And in what discipline?
How many credit hours?
Ooh, can I guess?
Yes. Yes, you may guess.
Like
3 in physical education.
Like,
no.
Okay.
Like, you mean like maybe 1 a semester, 4 PE, and you can get 3 or something like that?
Something like that, but something like that. And in what discipline, please?
In what discipline? Let's see here.
And you call yourself a faculty member.
Really?
Well, I don't...
And who?
Yes. In what discipline? Well, you mean outside of music. Music and PE would be, I don't know, fitness training, maybe.
General education, fine arts.
Oh, yes. Well,
all right,
here's
your bonus question. Who is the chair of the Department of Music?
Oh, I know that. Clark Mizells.
Oh, it looks like measles. I like measles much better.
Measles.
Yes.
Ding, 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 ding. It is
okay.
Measles.
All right. All right, now let's get serious.
What do you mean, get serious?
Okay.
I was.
You're going to tell us about yourself now. Now it's time for you to report on your own biography, why you got into music, and what you're still doing there, especially down there where the snow never shines.
Academic.
Well, we got some flurries today. My 9:30 composition student was looking out the window when I was trying to explain to her a few things about string bowing, and I noticed it was flurrying out there, so she was not totally ignoring me for no good reason.
As we are.
Your biography, then. How did you get into all this? Where did you start? When you were a child, what happened? What dangerous thing happened to you that caused you to go into music composition?
I got drugged to piano lessons at a fairly young age, so that was that. And, you know, it's just one of those things where, as we often...
What things?
As we tell students, you know, you discover at some point where there's nothing else you'd rather do, and so that's what you do. But I started off fairly young, and...
Many people start off fairly young.
And not,
some
you,
people are even
yeah.
born fairly young.
That's right. And later on, it wasn't till about high school I decided, you know what, I really like this. This is kind of cool. And let me just go for it and see what happens. And, you know, that's that. Nothing necessarily spectacular. The only thing I think that's maybe interesting about my story, several things. I did grow up on a dairy farm.
Yes, let's hear about that dairy farm. Was it a real working dairy farm, and what kind of herd did you
have?
This
dairy farm would be, you know, probably half the size of Vermont. Well, no, okay, not really. But
thank you.
No, it's...
maybe the population.
Maybe. Well, good old Holstein cows, and
no young Holsteins. They're all old.
Yeah, good old.
What,
yeah,
what
old,
use is
old
that?
For, well, we had some young Holsteins, but they were bad. The young ones were bad. They didn't act very good. They sometimes got called names, you know, and they wouldn't behave and stuff. But the, yeah, I mean, this was a real true dairy farm. That's how my parents, my parents made and still make a living. And anyway, my mom does not, actually, she works outside of the farm, but that's what my dad does. It's a real, I would call it an agribusiness. It's more than just a farm. It's a real operation. But, you know, I got to experience milking cows and things like that, although fortunately, I was not a slave to that like some young farm lads are. I got to do what I wanted. But interestingly enough, out of that, we, meaning my siblings and I, got to do things like piano. So we kind of got, it was kind of neat, you know, and with technology and so forth, it's easier to bring, you know, Schubert to the, well, you all don't, let's see, Schubert's a bad example. I think you all don't care
very,
for Schubert.
You have chosen the worst example.
I didn't mean to, I shouldn't have said Schubert, it just came to mind because I remembered seeing something, and he's not necessarily one I'd have. But nonetheless, it's easier to bring Schubert to your living room than, you know, some cows into, you know, Central Park. So
But you did take up the bassoon, and I'm wondering exactly what the relationship was between the cows and your bassoon, particularly in terms of that kind of sonic similarity.
Ah, yes, yes. Well, the bassoon, it's practicality, you see. Just like the practicality on the farm, it was, well, the middle school had a bassoon, which you did not have to rent, so it was good. I get to play the bassoon. Of course, years later when I had to buy a bassoon, it was not the cheapest instrument out there. But anyway, at the time, for my parents, it made sense. And, you know, I'm glad I play it. But it does sometimes resemble a cow. And there is actually something. Are you all familiar with?
No.
No. Are you all familiar with the trick? This is one of the all-time great bassoon tricks. If you have a bassoonist hold down all the keys, and someone else comes along and places a hand on top of the bell and creates a vacuum, and the bassoonist sucks in the air so it kind of collapses the reed and then lets his or her mouth off of the reed, and it will make a little sort of like a goose fart or something like this. If you've never tried that, you should do it. It's one of the peculiarities in the instrument. Not used often enough.
Well, we played capped reeds, so we know very well the problem of getting the reed to make anything that sounds like a good sound most of the time.
Yes, yes, yes.
Crumb horns will definitely sound very sick. So, all right.
Speaking of sick,
let's hear some music.
Yes.
What do we start with? We have a couple things to choose from. What's a good start from you? And then give us an introduction to it, and then we'll come back and talk about it.
Well, let's see. Why don't you start with Parabolisms?
Why? Tell us why.
Well, let me tell you about Parabolisms. Well, Parabolisms has been a fun piece. The name for this, by the way, I always find it hard to name pieces. I think calling them silly names sometimes is silly. But nonetheless, the reason this is called Parabolisms is it's written for alto saxophone for a good friend and colleague of mine, and piano, and we're actually sort of a duo that we've played different places, and this piece quite a few places. But the saxophone is actually parabolic. The bore is parabolic. It's not conical like you might think. The original saxophone was a truly parabolic bore. Modern saxophone is a little more conical, but still sort of has parabolic shape to it. So, that's the name, and it's a pretty hard piece. It's written, you know, for someone specifically, for Richard Scruggs, and the other half of the Garber Scruggs duo. And, you know, I wrote some pretty hard stuff for him to play, altissimo writing, and he studied with one of the great saxophone teachers. And Rasher, and so it's been a good piece for us to do and to go around, and you know, to write something specifically for somebody is always nice. So
does it have a compositional point of view, or is it an entertainment piece? What's your goal with the piece?
Oh, it's not entertainment. I mean, it's per se. I mean, it's you know, a very serious piece for but it's the showcase. I guess, you know, it does showcase the saxophone, although the piano part's not easy. It's a duet. It's not meant to be a solo piece with just the piano doing something underneath, but, you know, it is the full range of the saxophone, and it's a pretty upbeat piece. I mean, most people respond to it in fairly good ways, but it's not easy to play. It's a fairly limited number of people who can play it, but it's, I guess it is what it is.
It is. All right, then. Here it is. What it is. Parabolisms by our guest today on Calvos and Damien.
In the house.
Ryan Gerber.
Thank you.
Vandalism's music by our guest today, Ryan Garber. When was that composed and when was it first heard?
Oh, another question for me. Well, it was composed, I think it was finished, let's see, 2005, and it was then probably played in public that same year. It's one of these pieces that my, as Richard said, it's one of those things when we were working on it, he said it's going to take us 3 or 4 times to do this, perform it publicly before it settles in.
Have you toured it?
We have toured it. We have toured it actually as far away as Germany. We got to do it a few years ago in Darmstadt at the academy there, and also Memmingen, a small town a little west of Munich, a very nice town there. And we've also played it several places in the U.S. We played it at Commerce College. And in, let's see, in New York, we played it for the Syracuse Society for New Music, and they played it on a radio station there, too. I've got a great, great New Music Society there, as you probably know, and also Hamilton College in New York. We played it a couple times here at school, and I'm probably leaving somewhere out, but it's been a good piece for us. And actually, just today, literally just about 30 minutes before you called, I found out that it's been accepted to be done on an international conference in Croatia for next year, if we hopefully can scrounge up the funding to make it over there, is always the key, but that'll work out. Oh, and I've left off, that's right, it's not been done at, I was going to say it was done at another place, but we did something else there, so... It's gotten a good thing, and it's it's a very practical thing. I tell my students, I mean, you know, you're better off in a lot of ways writing for your friends than maybe for someone who's and in my case, I mean, Richard's an excellent player, but you know, it's better off maybe getting someone who's good but is your friend and reliable than someone who's maybe a little better but is not really into it. You want somebody that's going to enjoy doing it and wants to do it for you.
What do you tell those students who have no friends?
Yeah, that's always difficult.
Antisocial, they cannot do the friend thing. Who do they write for? They're so sad.
Well, what I tell them is that that there are two guys in Vermont that would be their friend if they can ever make it up there.
And we would.
We would?
Yes, we are now.
Oh.
Send them all to us.
Yeah, sure. I tell them, and, you know, it's the distance is a little tricky, but so that usually helps out. I mean, knowing that they have two people in Vermont that really love them, that's almost as powerful as the ice cream that comes from up there.
Ooh, yes, you bet. Now, speaking of students, how did you get into this academic position, and what do you do there exactly?
Well... You know, a lot of times I tell students if they come to get a degree in composition, you know, this qualifies you to go get another degree in composition, which qualifies you to get another degree in composition, which qualifies you to go teach composition if you want to do that and can get a job. As I was working through my undergraduate, I mean, at some point I realized this is how it works, and I had to decide, do I want to teach or do I want to do something else? And, you know, I knew I'd compose. Either way, there are, of course, many options. You don't have to go into academics. But I really like teaching. I really like seeing people learn and that sort of thing, and the whole environment's nice, at least where I am. And so, you know, I decided this is what I want to do. I'll enjoy it. So, and it's fortunate. It's in some ways the university for composers is sort of like what maybe the monarchy was at some point. You know, Wagner had some nice Bavarian kings, and we kind of
Bavarian creams.
Kings.
Oh, kings. I see.
Bavarian kings.
I was thinking yum.
You know, Ludwig and all those guys. The Esterházy family and all this stuff for Haydn. And, you know, I have Carcinoma College. And they may not see themselves quite like that, which may be good. But you know, that's it's not a bad way to go. It's you know, I can't compose all day during the year. It's school year. It's tough. I've probably done better than some in terms of getting things done. But, you know, the students kind of keep things fresh and interesting, and it's always neat to see that energy come from them when they're first composing. And
do you also teach bassoon?
I do. At the moment,
I teach
organ.
Okay, but in terms of bassoon, do you teach 064, 164, and also 364?
Oh, I do. Yes.
So what happens to 264? Why is there no 264 in any of the curricula?
Yeah, that's a good question, but I don't know. I didn't make those numbers up. I think
we'll have to ask Dr. Measles.
I think that's what happens maybe if you only have half a bassoon, maybe. I'm not clear on that.
That's just a bass.
Something
or
like
an
that.
Oon.
Yeah.
Oon,
yes. Well, you know, we have to leave room in case, you know, we ever do off a Clyde or something like that. So it's just how it works. Well, actually, to be honest with you, it's very simple. 064 is for non-music majors. 164 is for underclassmen, and 364 is for upperclassmen. But we could have 1, 2, 3, and 4, but we don't.
We'll have to thank Dr. Measles for that.
Dr. Measles. Hey, let's hear something else.
Well, I was going to let him listen to the show, and now I've got to think carefully about this.
Oh, yeah, there you go. We'll send notices
to everybody.
Now,
actually, the truth of the matter is, he told me once that his name, when he was born growing up, that is how they pronounce it, but he chose later on to use a more distinguished Measles. So.
Ah, yes. So is the next piece of music also distinguished? That's a question.
Oh, yes, your next choice of what we're going to play.
Oh, the next choice. Gosh, all these choices. Well, why don't we go with the piano concerto and let's see, which movement?
We have the first and third
movement
of that here.
Yes, why don't we do the first movement?
Why not the third?
Well, because I wrote the first one to come first.
How very instructive.
Can we have them in order? Do you think we can play them both without a break? Or would you like to talk about them in between?
You know what? You can play them both without a break. That would be fine.
All right,
and the second movement, of course, if people really are listening and want to hear it, they can find that, of course, if they do enough Google searching, I'm sure.
You bet. Our guest is Ryan Garble. Listen to me. Our guest is Ryan Garber here today on Calvos and Damien
in the house.
And we're going to hear his piano concerto, the first and third movement. Music by Ryan Garber, our guest today on Calvus and Damien.
In the house.
So that was the first and third movements of his piano concerto. How do you get a piano concerto played?
It's very simple. You have an identical twin brother who is a conductor and his wife who is a pianist and a very fine one. And that's how you do it.
This is a nepotistic concerto.
Seems like it.
My goodness.
Yes. So... Yes, you nailed it. Well, yeah, that is very fortunate, I have to say. I should say a few things about my brother. He also does some composing. It's interesting.
His name is Aaron,
right? His name is Aaron, and he,
yes,
for 3 years after his undergraduate degree, went off and did some farming, and then he just realized that music was calling and went back and got a master's degree, and he's a full-time church musician, but also started a choral society and has a second one. He's done a lot of great things with them, and it's funny how the twin thing, no matter how much we sort of tried to ever go different ways, we always end up kind of going back in the same way. And he even ends up teaching a little part time now at a college, and I end up doing some things with choirs now. So it's funny, but it's fun to do that. And
maybe we can take a little diversion here. What does it mean to be a full-time church musician? That sounds like an impossibility up where we are.
Well, a full-time church musician or minister of music or whatever, like he plays at a Lutheran, he's at a Lutheran church, and he's the director of music plus the organist all rolled into one. So, and he would have... you know, not just, say, the adult choir, the chancel choir, but also he has several, you know, his children's choirs and handbell choirs. One of the neat things about church music programs is that when public schools, which where you are may not, this may not be the case, but here I think I can say is often the case, or it can be the case, when public schools sometimes are lagging in music education, some churches, some of the bigger churches can be a good place for that, you know, and maybe that's not their main reason for being, but, you know, handbells are great for learning rhythm and so forth. So that's one of the nice things about all of that is at least it gives some good general music education to kids who sometimes don't even get that anymore in school.
Okay, let's go back to your piano concerto, which we just heard a few minutes ago. And tell me a little bit about the sort of the musical composition of this, because it has a sort of a very almost 19th century feel about it. And then it has other sections in which you have this kind of developmental repetition that sounds like a little bit of minimalism sneaked in there. What's your way of working?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting the way you said that. And of course, you know, I think that all of what you said kind of, you know, with 20th century harmonies and so forth. You know, in a lot of ways, I think my thought process probably similar to Beethoven in terms of developing ideas and that sort of thing. I mean, I think it's it's just something that works pretty well. And I tend to do that more than try to spin out some, you know, great lyrical thing. What was it? I think Haydn said something once, you know, when I was younger, I had all these great ideas and didn't know what to do with them. And now I'm older and I have no ideas, but I would know what to do with them if I had them. So, you know, I tend to think you could take anything and make it into something just about. From a formal standpoint, the forms that I tend to like a lot are, you know, I like to have form in a piece. I mean, there's going to be something, and I like to have sections that come back, but rather than have just, you know, ternary or sonata form, have more of like a mosaic thing where you have several, you know, four or five sections that are coming back in different ways. And this is something that's been done, you know, for quite a while.
How do you work? I mean, you know, if you're going to sit down and write something, how do you go about it? Do you plan it out? Do you make sketches? Do you improvise and write down? Do you kind of come up with a grand scheme? Do you hand it off to your students like Telemann? What do you do?
No, I do not hand it off to my students, and I try not to do anything like Telemann. You know, all the above. It depends on different things. You know, being a pianist, you know, I probably get a lot of my ideas just generally sort of by messing around at the piano. It's hard for me to actually compose at the piano. I actually do a lot of composing away from the piano. I've always sort of made myself do that, but 'cause I tend to just goof around at the piano. But you know, I think you start with what you're writing for, figuring all that out, and just some general concepts. And I usually start, you know, with some sketches, you know, some motives, some ideas, some melodies, whatever you call it. And then at a certain point, I'll start writing. At a certain point in, once I start off with a little bit of that, you know, sort of make the bricks for the house, decide what the bricks are going to be. At a certain point, you know, build a wall, a little bit of a wall. At a certain point, say, okay, wait a minute, let's figure out the whole structure here, and go from there. You know, Stravinsky said something once about, you know, he'd always write the ending first. Well, I don't know that I do that. I tend to write the beginning, and then a little ways in, realize, have to figure out where the ending is, and then, you know, fill in all the gaps. That tends to be how I work. I do, You know, but I think the whole thing with the plan is it's good to have a plan, but it's also good to not be bound to that. To, you know, if I'm always, it seems like I'm always telling my students, you know, it's okay to have a great idea, but if you get to the point where the great idea is not giving you good music, you can get rid of it. You know, it's okay. It's okay to say, well, I wanted an F sharp here, but, you know, I set up this whole system and here I end up with, you know, I mean, I've read so many descriptions of pieces where it sounds like this, you know, they've just solved the mystery of the universe, and you hear the piece and you think, well, I don't know. So, you know, one has to be very careful what you set yourself up for. And at the end of the day, you know, I think music has to, you know, you have to be satisfied with it. And it's hard to pin down why that is. You can't describe it in intervals and everything else per se, but have some connection all the way through. And, you know, so I might have answered your question there.
Well, how do you guide? Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
How do you guide your students? I mean, it sounds like you're very vague about how you approach your own work, at least in the way you describe it. How do you guide them? Do you look at them? Do you critique them? As a teacher of composition, how do you help them out?
Yeah, well, you know, some people, Bartok most famously said you can't teach composition, which is partly true, but you know, there's certain concrete things you can teach. You can say,
yeah, but they're paying you, baby. They're paying you.
Right.
We got to find out here.
That's right. Well, I mean, obviously, there's things like the ranges of instruments. Of course, they can be stretched, but you know, you can't write certain notes for certain instruments and bowings and you know, the basic things and all that, and even, you know, even the basic part writing and all that stuff. They're sort of those things. In terms of rules, a lot of times I tell my students, and I'm working with undergraduate students here, so there are a lot of times coming in, you know, really just starting out. And when I tell them about rules, I say, you know, it doesn't matter if you write parallel fifths or whatever you do with dissonance, but if you set up a world and an expectation, you know, you can't sort of be writing in a world and then all of a sudden have it, you know, your music shouldn't sound like an accident. So even if you have music that's juxtaposing lots of styles, you know, there's still always a craft there. In every style, there's always a craft. Even it doesn't matter what it is, you know, if you're doing total juxtaposition of things, that's okay, but it shouldn't sound like an accident unless you meant for it to sound like an accident, of course, and then the accident was on purpose. But there's certain kind of rules. It's like gravity. I like to use an analogy I've made of an airplane. I mean, if you want to say I'm going to build a new airplane, there's certain laws of aerodynamics, not many of which I could tell you, but that you need for the airplane to fly. And, you know, if you forget about gravity and all that, it's not going to fly. Now one could argue that if it doesn't fly, it could still be an airplane just sitting on the ground, you know, and that there might be some, experimental pieces that maybe, in a sense, don't fly, but they're still pieces and they're still worthy of our attention. You know, in terms of style, I mean, I don't guide my students at all that way. What I do is I have them listen to music. This is a great way of... They're required to listen, and they're required to read some books on composition. But that's a great way, I think, to sort of gently expose them to things, you know, stylistically, and then they'll just do whatever they want to do.
Do you give them your own music to play and explain it to them?
You know, if they don't have anything for their lesson, I sometimes will say, I'm now going to subject you to this piece I wrote. As punishment for not having written anything. I don't do a lot of that, you know. I maybe should more, but I don't know. I think it's a little presumptuous to do. I mean, today, I mean, sometimes I'll pull out like a part, you know. If I tend to use my music as examples from technical standpoints as much as anything else. you know, I'll pull out a part for a violin or something and say, you know, see, this is where the violinist went and marked some bowings in, and this is what I'd done, and this is, you know, that sort of thing. You know, they can go to my website and listen to my music. You know, if they want to, they can. And some of them show interest. I have a student right now who's a saxophone player, really wants some saxophone things and so forth. But I think it's very, you know, you can put your students in an awkward place talking about your music. I mean, they might, you know, they might wonder what their response is supposed to be. So, yeah, I usually put copies of things in the library, and if they want to go listen to it, they can. They know where it is. But, you know,
we're gonna play your a three-part piece of yours called Resonances, or is it Résonance? Which is your préférence?
Either one or either one doesn't matter to me.
Okay. Well, all right. Resonances it is. The three movements. And while we're playing this, we're going to ask you a question to think about. What three recordings three compositions would you choose to have your students study most importantly, and what three probably influenced you the most? So we're going to listen to our guest, J. Ryan Garber, here on Calvus and Damien
in the house.
We're going to hear three movements. Resonances.